Hi, and welcome to the Irish American Politics Show. I'm your host, Gina London, and in this special series, we set out to explore and examine through the eyes of the Irish American voter what is being described as the most divisive presidential campaign in U.S. history. And in this episode, we are really delighted to be talking with Stella O'Leary. She's a highly regarded and prominent figure in the Irish American community today. Not only did she found the Irish American Political Action Committee, she also actively played a role in the campaigns for president for Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton. Stella O'Leary, it is a real pleasure to welcome you to the show.
Glad to be here, Gina.
Thanks, Stella. Let's take back a moment, because you have been so influential and know past presidents and past presidential candidates, as we talk about Hillary Clinton. Take us back to when you first met Bill and Hillary Clinton and what your thoughts were of them as they were on the political stage.
Well, I first met them in Bill Clinton's election in 1996. And we were concerned that if he was not elected, that the Good Friday Agreement would never happen. I'm sure it would have been dropped as an issue. So we coordinated our efforts, and I headed up the Political Action Committee to bring together the Irish American community and to get them working for Bill's election. So at that time, I met him and Hillary and got to know them well, and they, you know, had from then on a very good relationship with them all the way through to, it seemed like so many elections, because I thought we would just exist for Bill Clinton's election. But as soon as he finished his term, his wife went for the Senate. And of course, she had been a wonderful help on Ireland. So we worked for her election to the Senate. And then she decided to run for president. So, and then she was thinking of running for the presidency in the previous election, but she decided against it. And so we talked to her about that. And then finally she decided she would run. And then the rest is history.
Tell me a little bit, Stella, about the pact that you formed. And you said you formed it in 1996 in an effort to help Bill Clinton win his second term. What was it? What were you doing here in Ireland before, or in Ireland with the Irish American community, that made you feel like you could even form a pact? And then talk about what your pact particularly did in its effort with Bill and Hillary Clinton.
Well, you know, I'd never been in politics before. I had no idea. So all I did was call the Federal Elections Commission and ask them, what do I do? And they said, you start a political action committee, which I did. I had no background in politics whatsoever. So,
but you have a passion. I asked,
sorry?
I said, you have a passion.
Yeah, passion, right. I had a lot of passion, right. And it turned out I had the ability to raise money. And it turned out, you know, I was the Irish American community was very willing to join me and to work with me. So it wasn't a hard effort. It was relatively easy. And so I did everything that politicians do. I raised money, I opened websites, I got bumper stickers, I sent out newsletters, and all that. And we worked together. And as I said, was once in the White House, then we held Bill Clinton to his promise. He had promised that he would send an envoy to Ireland if he won the election, and he did, as you know, send George Mitchell.
Did you have any? I was going to ask you. Did you have any influence in suggesting Senator George Mitchell from Maine?
No, I didn't. No, that was Bill Clinton's choice, and the only role I played in that was on the various trips to Ireland. Particularly when Bill Clinton went over, I went with him, and as part of a group of supporters that had some knowledge of the Irish issue, including congressional members and, you know, Terry McAuliffe and people like that.
Is there a story that you can share, Stella, when you were in with the president at that time? Is there a story of that maybe you haven't shared recently, but with some insight into his style, into his politics?
Well, you know, in terms of Ireland, the story I like the best is one night, very late one night, where we were sitting around and his daughter was there. And we were chatting, a group of us chatting with him. And this was about when he was about to leave office, I think. And as he said, you know what, I think I'll run for president of Ireland. He said, the Irish love me, and I could be president of Ireland. And he said, the second group who really like me are the French. So he said, I could run for president of France, because the Arkansas was part of the Louisiana Purchase. So they're eligible to work to run for. And his daughter said to him, Dad, you should learn the language before you decide to run for president of France. So he never did run for either presidencies, but I thought that was very amusing.
Now I'm going to have to press you on this one, Stella. Where was this conversation? Were you in a pub somewhere?
No, we were in a hotel in Derry. And I believe he had just received an award from McGee University. John Hume presented an award to him. And it was that evening. We went over so many times, forget what happened at which time, but he went over a great number of times, and Hillary did too. And even after even between elections, Hillary went over quite a bit, and I went with him. She spoke in Dublin, and it just seems like everywhere in Ireland.
You know, I want to talk a little bit. I want to spend some time talking about Hillary Clinton too, of course, because I want to spend some time talking about Barack Obama. I don't want to lose track of the order, but because we're talking about the Clintons, let's move over to Hillary Clinton for a second. Also, because she was the person who ran against Trump and of course won the popular vote in the last election in 2015, 2016. What would you say as you were meeting her? Did you feel that she had back in 1996? And so did you feel like she had presidential or even senatorial aspirations at that time? What were you picking up from her at that point?
At the point when she was running or
when you first when you were first meeting her, how did she strike you initially?
Oh, as a potential presidential candidate?
In terms of her political aspirations, how did she come across to you when you met her? Did you feel like here's someone who's going to make her mark beyond being first lady, or was she at that first?
Oh yeah. I mean, extremely, very, very impressive. I mean, about as impressive as is possible for anybody in government to be. Just her, her range of knowledge, her understanding. And, I found her very personable, great sense of humor, and just qualified beyond words. It's amazing considering what we're going through. It's just heartbreaking that what we could have had was this woman who was so qualified and so ready to be president, and knew, I mean, what she not only knew the generals in foreign countries, she knew people on the staff. She knew people all over the world and all the governments. There was nothing she didn't know about in terms of government globally and domestically.
That is a very interesting point. When you talk about the credibility, the CV, if you will, the experience, the connections that you described that this woman had. And yet, of course, it was the Electoral College that actually allowed President Trump to take his role in the White House. But if the fact that it was as close of a margin as it was is still striking when you think about all those credentials stacked up against the perception that it was of this not part of establishment, although we can argue that, person that is in Donald Trump. What do you think it is about this character, Donald Trump, that is so captivating and inarguably compelling for so many people? What is it about his personal communication style that makes him connect to some people?
Yeah. Yeah, his communication style is very central to who he is, and he's actually quite good at communicating. You know, he's a salesman, and you know, his hand gestures, his you know, his jokes, his comedic form. He does relate to his audience, and he gets through. He knows how to communicate with them. And he feeds to their issues exactly, so he would have to acknowledge that what he does in communicating, he does very well, very competently.
When you contrast his style to that of Hillary Clinton's, and then there was that, of course, those moments on the debate floor where there was such a difference between the two of them, and yet he ended up becoming the man in the White House. Talk a little bit about, as you and I are recording and having this conversation today, it might be watched by people at different times, but we are less than a week away from the first presidential debate in Cleveland, where those two candidates, of course, Donald Trump running for re-election and now Democratic candidate Joe Biden, will be squaring off together for the first time with just one moderator, which is different than before because of all the considerations and precautions around COVID. I'd love to hear your perspective on what you think Joe Biden, what the tone, what the style that he needs to take to be perceived as the winner in that debate.
Well, you know, I think in both cases, they're going to come across as they are, as themselves. And in Joe Biden's case, you know, it's passion, sincerity, you know, empathy, feeling, just the story of his life, the story of the tragedies of his loss of his son, the loss of his wife and child. And you know, when you listen to him, you have no doubt whatsoever that he is sincere and that, you know, he's not faking in any way. Also, I would expect from Joe Biden, because, you know, he's a very long government experience. He was a Judiciary Committee and chair of the Foreign Relations. So he's very, very knowledgeable. So the form of a kind of government he will be presenting, you know, is full, like Hillary Clinton. He has a lot of information. He knows a lot. So it'll be very content. There'll be lots of content. Whereas if you want to switch to the other side, you have a very different presentation.
Yeah. And as we've seen, the style versus the substance doesn't always carry the day. If within Hillary and Donald Trump in the way that it ultimately came out. Question for you then on style, because you did mention, and I agree with you from what I've seen, and I've met Joe Biden several times back when he was senator and vice president. His style of authenticity, his style of speaking from the heart, his potential long-winded stories to illustrate a point, but yet that they are heartfelt stories, is also a part of his character, that incendiary boxer style that is a bit like a Donald Trump. Do you think, because Hillary kept her cool largely when they were on the debate floor, do you think, prediction time, is there any situation in which Donald Trump pushes one of Joe Biden's buttons and he goes off?
I know. I don't think he can do that very well with this man, because he's very seasoned and very, he's been in this a long time, and I don't think he'd be swayed or upset, no matter what. I think he'd be able to handle that very, very well. But it seems to be the only style that Trump has. I don't know. He's the one that needs to come up with something. You know, some substance or something that to stand his ground in this. However, you did mention Biden's weakness, which is these anecdotes that he likes to meander on about. And the good news in this is the moderator will cut him off, so that won't be a problem, because he loves to talk to people. You know, he's more comfortable in an ice cream parlor than he is in before a podium. And so he's a retail politician. He likes people, and he likes to talk to them about their lives and so forth. So, I mean, it's a totally polar opposite style to Trump's.
Let's talk about that connectability factor that you were talking about with Joe Biden feeling more comfortable in the ice cream parlor, and maybe Donald Trump feeling more connecting when he's in these big rallies or his old World Wrestling Federation style of approach in those days. Yeah. In your experience, Stella, because you've covered lots of, you've been impactful with your PAC in a lot of different presidential campaigns. At this point in the game, with so few undecided, what connectability does it take in the last 30 some days in an election to win over voters? In your experience, what is it that pushes people to finally go in and make up their minds?
And, you know, that's very hard to say. I presume those who are undecided are waiting for something that really, hits home with them. And so it would depend on their issue. The problem that Trump has is that he has three groups that he can count on completely. And unfortunately for him, and thank God for us, it's not a majority, but he can count on, you know, what Hillary called the deplorables, the neo-Nazis who are going around town now with AK-47s and have all kinds of conspiracy theories. And then he has the evangelicals, and he has the right-wing Catholics, you know, Bill Barr and Newt Gingrich and all these people. And their issue is abortion. And abortion is his issue, but it's only a front. He doesn't care about abortion. It's his way of reaching these people. And then he has the very wealthy, the 1%, because he protects them. So he's talking to those groups. And so what would sway the undecideds if they can figure out what a con man he is? And particularly if they can be persuaded that he doesn't represent their interests. What's happening is he's fooling most of the people, not most of the people, but a large number of the people all the time. He's feeding into their prejudices and so forth. And so if they could see through him, in other words, but he still has, those groups don't make up a majority for him. And so he has to try, you know, illegal methods to change the election result, or or get lucky with the Electoral College again. But Hillary won by 3 million votes. That's a lot of votes.
I know that's the frustration. That's the frustrating component to many people then about the Electoral College, and that why the United States is really a republic and not a pure democracy in terms of one person, one vote. You're absolutely right. Having been on the 2000 election when I was still with CNN, standing down there in Tallahassee as they were counting the hanging chads between Al Gore and George Bush, I can certainly feel that feeling of watching an election go a different way from the popular vote. Talk to me a little bit about, you were saying so eloquently, and I really love your insight, Stella. You were talking about the way different groups are being appealed to. And because you founded and represent the Irish American Political Action Committee, is there or are there a number of particular issues that are galvanizing Irish American voters these days? Or is it an amalgam? And how strong is that voice?
Well, you know, you would have to go back to the groups I was talking about. I mean, a lot of the Irish Americans fall into that right-wing Catholic group. And I don't believe that Donald Trump cares one whit about abortion, but it's his way of, you know, he can woo them on that issue. And then they don't seem to care about children in cages or reintroducing executions. But they care apparently about this issue. So a lot of the Irish Americans fall into that category, and they would be in that in his camp, period. They're not changing their minds. But in the rest of the Irish, it would be a mixture of issues, economic and unions. The unions still have a great number of Irish Americans, and they have a lot of influence. And so most all of the, I believe all of the international presidents have endorsed Biden. So that's looking good. There'll be a lot of Irish community. But in places like Pennsylvania that Hillary lost by a very small amount, we desperately need. So we're working very hard in Pennsylvania.
Tell me about some of your efforts there in Pennsylvania, Stella.
Well, we're having Irish webinars, you know, because we have to do everything online. So the Irish webinars have Irish performers, and then we bring up the issues. And congressmen like Connor Lamb of Pittsburgh, who is in an all Republican area, but he's a Democrat. So we're very much using somebody like Connor Lamb, because that's a swing vote right there. And there's a lot of swing voting in Pennsylvania. It was traditionally a Democratic, but now because of the divisions that Trump and others have created, there people are falling into, you know, into opposite camps, and that's very unfortunate. So the issues that would drive them are the health care, because Trump is going to eliminate the Affordable Care Act, and they would be motivated the economy is not good for them. You know, it's good for the very rich. So I think the Affordable Care, and the other thing he's attacking is Social Security. So right. In fact, a lot of these people in the so-called deplorables, they're working against their own interests. They're working against themselves by voting for Trump. He's going to take their Social Security, and he's going to take their health care. And a very interesting fact on that, which fascinated, if that's the right word. I now heard that if it goes back to private insurance, that a pre-existing condition will be if you had COVID. If you had COVID, they will consider that a pre-existing condition and deny you insurance.
Imagine that you're the president who oversaw the worst management of the precautions and the treatments and the oversight of COVID. And then, in fact, you're using that as a pre-existing condition. Fascinating, as you said. Stella, I have two more questions for you, because I could listen to you all day long. This is an incredible perspective. But I don't want to leave Barack Obama off our discussion. And if you've got a story about your interaction with him, because I know he also was welcomed and loved here when he came to Ireland, a story about Barack Obama, and then I'll ask you another question.
Oh, yes. Barack is just wonderful. He's, he's so amused at the idea of his Irishness. And he loves to tell the story, which is in his book, that when he says, I wish I had known that when I was in Chicago, because he said they put me in the St. Patrick's Day parade. I was the very last truck or whatever display in the parade. And he said they were actually cleaning up behind me. So I played no role. If I had known I was Irish, I could have been in the front of the parade. So he's very amused at the end. He loves it, of course. And he's very, very amused at it. So he gave wonderful St. Patrick's Day parties at the White House. Just wonderful. And really, as I say, really loves the idea. Yeah, so hopefully we can keep him interested and keep him going back to Ireland in the future.
Mm-hmm. That would be great. I said I had one more question, but I actually have two. Let me ask you a little bit of your reflections. We were talking about issues that matter to the voters as we're looking at that percentage that might be still undecided and where they might go. What, against the backdrop of the Black Lives Matter protests, of course, COVID, as we mentioned, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death and the replacement for her and the fuss around the fight around that, is that going to have any impact to an undecided voter, or are their minds already made up? What do you think about those backdrops?
I think with the with Ginsburg's death, he's obviously trying to use this in his self-congratulatory way that this is a great achievement for him to pack the court to this extent. Again, it's how people will receive it. Obviously, the anti-abortion people will receive it, and the I don't know whether they realize the first bill coming up in before the Supreme Court is the Affordable Care Act. And they're going to lose their, medical insurance. So whether they're paying attention to that or not, I don't know. Unfortunately, with the Black Lives Matter, he's using it again politically to foment, to stoke the culture wars and to create division between us. And so he, no matter whether it's a peaceful march or a non-peaceful march, he labels it all, law and order violations, and whatever, we're being attacked by some forces beyond our control and all this kind of thing. So I think people will for the most part stay in the camp. I'm still very confident that Joe Biden has the majority of the United States right now, no question. Yeah, the
Yeah,
question
some
is,
polls
can
put
we
him up.
win?
Right, some polls
Yeah,
put
can
him up more than 8-12%, and that's well above the margin of error. So you're right. So that leads me into my final question then, which is another prediction question, but we can't wrap up about presidential debates and this election and your experience having worked with presidential campaigns. So if you're going to call the election today, not just for president, let's do president last first. Is there a chance that the Senate flips in this election, in your opinion?
Very, very, very definitely, very definitely a chance, particularly if Biden holds to that majority. And but I'll tell you, since Hillary's defeat, if you want to call it that, I'm not I never feel that secure about anything
Yeah.
anymore, whether it be polls or anything else. So it's just as the polls are saying, we could very possibly take the Senate, and I think if Biden wins, what we're seeing here in the District Virginia area, voting has already begun here, and
Right.
people are
Early
loving
voting started in a number of
the
states. You're
early
right.
vote, but they've got 40 days to go. They're out there now. They're in line for 4 hours waiting
Yes.
to vote. So there are people. So I'm hoping that. But I guess if you went into a red state, you might find the same on the other side. So depends on where the enthusiasm is greatest, and hopefully we can have enough of a victory that he's not able to make a fuss about it. So.
Right, because he's even today calling the ballots a disaster and still trying to put a lot of confusion around the mail-in ballots and the election system as it is under COVID right now these days, and looking like he's going to be very reluctant unless, as you say, there's a real strong margin of an indicator that he's been defeated. Stella O'Leary, it has been an absolute pleasure listening to you and learning from you. And hopefully, we'll see about your predictions as we come just a few weeks away to this decision on the US presidential election. And thank you once again to Stella O'Leary, the founder of the Irish American Political Action Committee. And that wraps this episode of the Irish American Politics Show. I'm Gina London, and we look forward to seeing you next time.